I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Chances are you've taken the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator. It's the most popular personality test in the world and has been used by companies, governments, universities, self-improvement classes, dating sites to categorize people on extroversion, introversion, sensing, intuition, thinking, feeling, and judging perception. My staff and I filled out a free version of Myers-Briggs yesterday, and I'm apparently ENFJ-A. You can go to our Facebook page and check out a short video of what we found. Merve Emery tells the story behind the MBTI and the mother and daughter, Catherine Briggs and Isabel Briggs Myers, who created the instrument in her book titled The Personality Brokers. They were intrigued, really obsessed with the ideas of Carl Jung and had no formal psychological training. Emery writes how Catherine created a, quote, cosmic laboratory of baby training in her living room, using her daughter and neighborhood children to create civilized adults. Well, needless to say, we were intrigued with what she found and asked Merve Emery to join us on Radio Times. She's a professor of English literature at Oxford University, joins us from the BBC studios at Oxford. And Merve Emery, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
I guess the most obvious place to start is, what is your personality type?
I am an ENTJ, which is the type favored by most CEOs and dictators. So I'm excited to speak with you.
Absolutely. You'll be bossing me around the whole hour. I can just tell.
Listen, I ask the questions here.
Yeah. Exactly. What do you think? We'll talk about why it's not scientific, but it's clearly popular. And what do you think explains its appeal?
So in the book, what I argue is that the question of its scientific validity and reliability is actually besides the point. Right. And the reason it's popular is because it offers an incredibly compelling language of the self that we can use to describe ourselves and that we can use to describe others. And not only to describe who we are, but to accept who we are, not to apologize for who we are, and to make our personality preferences, to make ourselves the masters and arbiters of our own destinies. And I think that's a really seductive vision to offer people, both the promise of self-knowledge and then through self-knowledge, the promise of self-governance.
Well, it's interesting because reading the book, I mean, you clearly are skeptical about a number of things about Myers-Briggs, but nonetheless, you took a 5-day class and you saw how meaningful this was to people and how, as you just explained, how it really gave them some kind of guidance about who they were and perhaps how they were going to live their lives.
Yeah, so I should add a little bit of context to that. So the reason for taking that 5-day class was because I was told that I could only get access to the papers of Isabel Briggs Myers, one of the co-creators of the Indicator, if I had taken this class. And it was described, in fact, not as a class, but as a re-education program. So make of that what you will.
Exactly.
But one of the interesting things was that, you know, obviously I'm skeptical. I'm skeptical not just of the Indicator itself, but really of the Indicator as symptomatic of ways that we think about individuals, especially under late capitalism. But one of the things that I saw when I went to that class was the way in which these scenes of self-discovery evoked a very real set of emotions in people, a set of emotions that sometimes tended to be almost quasi-spiritual or religious. And what I wanted to understand was why people experienced what they did when they discovered their types, especially when many of them knew that the type indicator was not valid or reliable, when they knew that it was something mass-produced, why they continued to feel the kind of attachment that they did to that language of type that I saw enacted in that classroom.
Well, let's talk about some of the problems with Myers-Briggs. Is obviously, we're talking about 16 types. It's essentially kind of a, yeah, are you this or are you that? It's self-administered, which means that people can make of it, I guess, as they will. In fact, there was some research done that half the people who took the Myers-Briggs, when they took it again, got a different score. So here you see all these people that are very excited about what they found, and yet, if it's not scientifically valid, are they deluding themselves? Is this dangerous?
Well, I mean, I think the question of whether it's dangerous or not has to be negotiated differently when you're talking about individual experiences of self-discovery versus the way that massive social institutions, political and economic and social institutions, use things like personality tests to rationalize their labor forces. So in terms of individuals having these experiences of self-discovery, no, I wouldn't use the word delusional, because I think what it's offering them is a vocabulary of the self. And that vocabulary isn't any more or less delusional than other vocabularies of the self. And I think what's really interesting is seeing the way that vocabulary gets used. So for instance, if I tell you I'm an extrovert and you too are an extrovert, right? You and I now have some sense that we know something about the other person, even though we've never met before. We know nothing of each other's life experiences, but we seem to share something in common just by using that language of extroversion to describe our personality preferences. And so I don't think that's delusional. I think it's both a really powerful practice of the self, and it's also a really powerful practice of social connection. Language becomes a kind of glue that can bind people together, people who are really total strangers. And one of the interesting things is that some of the different types have type support groups,
right,
where people of particular types, you know, some of the rarer types go and talk to one another, and they do kind of create this really sort of intimate scene around their type knowledge. So, you know, I think on the individual level, what's happening is not delusion so much as it is a kind of quest for meaning, the desire to take all of the messiness and complexity of our psychological and emotional realities and make them into something coherent, and then to use that sense of coherence to manage our own lives. I mean, that seems
sure
sort of profoundly human in many ways.
And a way of connecting with others who might have shared interests based on these personality profiles.
Well, and a way of accepting people who don't. So one of the most interesting places where type testing is used is in couples counseling. And so there were a lot of stories at the class that I went to of people who went to couples counselors and had, you know, were both discovered their own types and discovered their partner's types. And that it became a whole practice of acceptance of both oneself and the other person. And so I think it's both, you know, existing in some kind of existing in a way that's connected to other people of the same type, but also learning to accept differences between yourself and other people. And that's just a, you know, a kind of like fundamental sure aspect of being a social creature. And yet it's also one of the hardest things to accept, right, that people are different from us and that we have to just live with those differences. And so this is a vocabulary that offers a way to think about those differences.
And it's a non-judgmental vocabulary. I mean, you can be a combination of all these traits, but there's nothing, at least as originally conceived, that is judgmental about that, that one is better than the other.
Right. And of course, that's something we should be skeptical of.
Right.
But yes, as it was originally conceived, no one type is better than any other. These are not, they are not, the indicator is not designed to sort people into good or bad, normal or abnormal types. It's simply meant to realize that different people have different preferences and that we should respect those preferences. But the question you asked about deluding ourselves, I think, is very different when you look at the incredible history of the way that the indicator and other kinds of personality tests have been used, particularly the way that they have been used in institutions like corporations or universities or the military, that are used to reproduce the power of the dominant classes, and the ways in which certain personality types become yoked to the dominant classes, and the ways in which certain types of people actually cannot have access or are denied access to the language of individual personality. So one of the examples that I like to give is that when Isabel Briggs Myers designed the indicator in the early 1940s, she didn't believe that anybody with an IQ under 100 could take the indicator, because she believed that they lack the cognitive abilities to differentiate their personality preferences. And that, to me, is a really sort of interesting example of the ways in which this whole language of personality, the whole language of type that I've been delineating here and that I talk about in the book, becomes limited, becomes something exclusionary.
Well, what's interesting, too, in the 1950s and 60s, that introversion was really valued, and people who were extroverted were seen as people pleasers or superficial. And I would think today it's really the reverse of that. People are looking for that extrovert to have all that energy and ideas and all the kind of stereotypes that we associate with extroverts.
Right. I think that gets really powerfully at the lie that any of these categories are in any way essential or innate, because they are so constructed. So when Jung was writing Psychological Types in the 1923 English translation, the way that he defines the introvert and the extrovert is totally different from the way that we think about it today. So for him, the introvert and the extrovert position was all about one's orientation to subjectivity. So if you were an extrovert, you were an intensely chameleonic person. You were very likely to change how you presented yourself based on the external circumstances in which you found yourself. Versus the introvert, who was someone who had such an abiding sense of their own subjectivity, their own orientation to the world, that they were not likely to be swayed by external circumstances to change how they behaved.
Different.
Right. So the example he gives is on a blustery day, the extrovert is the person who says, well, I have to put my hat on, my coat on to go outside. And the introvert says, no, I will let the elements harden me. I'm going outside without my hat and my coat on. And of course, that has nothing to do with being quiet or shy, as we typically associate with introversion today, or being outgoing or gregarious, and being social, which is what we associate with extroversion. The way those definitions have come to be laminated onto introversion and extroversion has a kind of complex corporate history to it.
Catherine Briggs and Isabel Briggs Myers met Carl Jung. You write about that in the book. Is there any way to know what Jung thought of what they did with his ideas?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I mean, a little bit of background might be helpful here. So when Catherine read Carl Jung's Psychological Types in 1923, she became completely fixated on it. And for the next 5 years, all she did was read and reread the book, and she kept these really sort of meticulous 3x5 index cards detailing all the questions she had about it. And she actually struck up a correspondence with Jung. And one of the things that she imagined was that she was his disciple, and that she would bring his language of type to the United States. And she also, by the way, wrote gay erotica about
right.
him, but that's another.
That's a whole other thing, which I hope we can get to, but no, go ahead. And Merve, just so you know, about 30 minutes or 30 seconds before a break, but go ahead.
Okay. So she started trying to treat people in the neighborhood. She tried to take on patients and wrote to Jung and said, they are your patients too. I am acting for you. You are acting through me. And he was very sort of disturbed by this because he hadn't authorized it, but also I think he had some, you know, he had a certain sort of sexist set of assumptions about how whether or not Catherine was able to do the kind of work that he was doing with his patients. And, you know, they met later on about 10 years after that in a hotel room in Boston. Should I save the rest of the story for after the break?
Let's do that. Otherwise,
okay.
I'm going to have to interrupt you. And that's
All
Merve
right.
Emre, and she's our guest on Radio Times today. Also the author of a book called The Personality Brokers, The Strange History of Myers-Briggs and the Birth of Personality Testing. You can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after the short break. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about Myers-Briggs Type Indicator. That's the personality test that has become so popular. And Merve Emre has written a book about the test, but also about the mother and daughter, Catherine Briggs and Isabel Briggs Myers, who created this instrument, as they called it, not a test. And her book is called The Personality Brokers. Just pick up very briefly on Jung, and then Merve, I've got a bunch of questions to you about Catherine and Isabel. But go ahead about Jung.
Oh, so where had I left off? Had I left off with the erotic fan fiction? Or
yeah,
where was
we
I?
Did that. We did the erotic
did
fan
that.
Fiction.
Okay,
no,
that
he was rather disturbed that they were so kind of, especially Catherine, so obsessed with his ideas and thinking of herself as a disciple.
Yeah, so he was quite put off, I think, by the way in which she wanted to actively seek out people to try to remake them along these typological lines. And he writes this really interesting letter to her where he says, "You are being altogether too Christian about it. If people want your help, they need to come to you. You can't seek people out and try to sort of tell them what their types are, basically." And so she falls back a little bit. And, you know, by the time Isabel designs the type indicator in the 40s, you know, about 15 years afterwards, Young is quite sick. He's about to die. She wants to visit him. She sends him a copy of the questionnaire and the answer sheets. And he basically writes back quite politely saying, "I respect your thinking on this. I haven't thought about these things for quite a long time, but I'm happy to see how you've advanced my thinking on it." So I would characterize his sort of early reaction to their efforts as being skeptical, disdainful, maybe, you know, begrudgingly respectful of Catherine's the intensity with which she engaged his ideas, but never actually supportive. And then by the end, he's just kind of checked out.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. And Catherine Cook Briggs has a daughter, Isabel. And she has some ideas about how she wants to raise her daughter, focusing on things like obedience and curiosity. Although, as you say, those are really in many ways in contradiction to themselves. And she creates this laboratory for her daughter, but also for, it seems like, other children in the neighborhood as a way to raise them to become these civilized adults. And she has these kind of no-no tests and then the ways of rewarding behavior. Help us understand what was going on in this living room.
Well, I'll start a little bit before the living room and just point out that Catherine Cook Briggs was an extraordinary woman. She went to college at the age of 15, graduated at 18 at the top of her class at Michigan Agricultural College. She married the man who was, of course, number two to her number one. And when they moved to Washington, D.C. for him to continue his work, she was never expected to go on with her education. And her parents give her a kind of chest full of linens to help decorate her home, and they give her husband $200 for his postgraduate education. And Catherine goes, and she has three children. The oldest is Isabel, and the younger two are boys, both of whom die quite early in infancy. And she's absolutely devastated. And she starts asking herself, what does it mean to have a child? What does it mean to raise a child? And once you raise a child, once, you know, what can you do other than ensure a child's survival? And to her, this becomes a question of how to save her children's souls and how to save the souls of all children. And the answer that she lands on is really interesting. Yeah. It's that she thinks that children ought to learn from a very young age how to specialize, that you should be able to gauge a child's personality from a very early age, and based on their personality, you should be able to direct them to specialize in the line of work that will be best suited for them. And she believes that this will help them grow up into civilized adults, but it will also help generate a more efficient society. And so she starts in her living room what she calls the Cosmic Laboratory of Baby Training. And part of what she is doing in that cosmic laboratory is actually designing and administering the very first personality tests. They are forced choice questionnaires similar to the Myers-Briggs. So you have a question and you can choose between A or B. And she's using those personality tests to try to decide what the personalities of these children are, and then based on their personalities, create these sort of blueprints for highly specialized educational plans to get them to become the specialized adults that they should be.
Well, it's so interesting because it raises so many questions. One being, how did that compare to how children were being raised at this time? And this is, I guess, at the very end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. Were these outlandish ideas, or did they fit the growing knowledge about what children needed at that time?
No, in some ways they arise from her real frustration with progressive education in the United States, and she believes that the great downside of progressive education is that it treats children en masse, and they become these sort of attentive sheep that are indistinguishable from one another. And so she wants to restore to early childhood education a kind of a sense of individuality, a sense of specialization for each child. And so she actually doesn't send Isabel to school at all, or she writes in her diaries that she sends her only as her tastes befit it. So she'll, you know, occasionally go to some classes in sixth grade and then not go to seventh or eighth grade and then maybe take a math class in ninth grade. But she's not in school for any sustained period of time.
Well, if Isabel is an example of how this worked or didn't work, she was perhaps not a genius, but she was clearly a very accomplished person. She excelled in a number of different areas. So what does that tell us, do you think?
Well, her mother has these sort of devastating lines in her diary about her daughter where she says, "My daughter is not a genius. She's merely an obedience curiosity child." So she is the child that I made her into.
Yikes.
And it's this really, it's this really fascinating sort of spectacle of maternal control. And her daughter, you know, submits to this for a very, very long time until she goes to college. She goes to Swarthmore. And she goes to college and she realizes that she is free from the sort of incessant surveillance of her mother's obedience curiosity program and that she can think a little bit more about who it is that she wants to become. Although, of course, when you've been under that kind of, when you've been taught to practice a particular way of being for, you know, 16, 17 years, it's hard to get out from under it as easily as one might imagine. So she goes off to Swarthmore. She also graduates, I think, at the top of her class there. And she meets a man and she decides that what she wants to do is get married and have children. And she wants to become what she and her mother both describe in exalted terms as their man's helpmeet, as a good housewife. And one of the really interesting things to me that's behind the choice to be a mother, to be a quote-unquote housewife, is the way that both of these women want to figure out how to professionalize that. So they want to make visible to other people that there's a kind of labor that goes on there that's often not visible, that they are not just having children and taking care of their homes and their husbands because it's part of their because it's what they ought to do, but they are choosing to do this because it's parts of their personalities, and they're choosing to specialize this aspect of their personality. And they both very much view the kind of everyday human relations that take place in the household, and Isabel articulates this quite eloquently later on, that they view the kind of everyday relations that are being managed in the household as being very similar to the work of personnel management in the company, to the work of human relations in corporations.
And I think that's what made them so really fascinating. And it's funny, reading a couple of reviews of your book, I saw the word two housewives, you know, coming up with Myers-Briggs. But I think the use of housewives was to, in a sense, diminish what it was that they were actually doing. I mean, there's much you can find fault with, but nonetheless, as you said, they really wanted to professionalize what it was to raise children, what it was to be a wife and mother.
I think that's right. And I think the fault isn't with the term housewife, but rather with the larger structures that work to make the labor that women perform in the house and the labor that women perform through childcare seem like it's not labor because it's not waged work. And so it doesn't seem like work, but of course that's what it is. And it's the work of social reproduction on which our economy is completely dependent.
Do you think they thought that way?
You know, there are moments where they seem to be they seem about to articulate something like what I've just articulated, but often they just fall back on these sort of frustrating, naturalized divisions between men and women. So Catherine, in a lot of her writings, talks about how men are like canaries and women are like fish. And there are these sorts of biologized differences that make women more inclined to feeling and men more inclined to thinking. And that's why women end up doing a lot of the housework and the work of childcare is because they simply are the more feeling sex. And she kind of gets halfway there sometimes when she recognizes that This means that they disproportionately do the work of social reproduction, but she doesn't really get the cause and the effect right.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Merve Emre, and we're talking about her new book. It's called The Personality Brokers, The Strange History of Myers-Briggs and the Birth of Personality Testing. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And Merve, there are a lot of people that want to talk about the Myers-Briggs as it does exist today, and I do want to get us up to present day, because I think there is a lot to talk about. But what is interesting is how this mother-daughter, it's really the daughter who begins to sell this idea to companies that begin to use it, or even the government that begins to use it as a kind of sorting mechanism.
Yes, that's right. So Isabel, the daughter, is the one who actually designs the questionnaire, and her mother is intensely skeptical of using a questionnaire in the first place, because she thinks, you know, she spent her whole life trying to figure out how to type people. She doesn't think you can give this over to a, you know, to a kind of impersonal form. But Isabel's the one who designs the questionnaire, and she starts working with one of the first personnel management consultants in the Northeast, a guy named Edward Hay. And Edward Hay starts introducing the type indicator to his clients, and they include Standard Oil, General Electric, the New York Life Insurance Company, the OSS, the precursor to the CIA, uses it to try to fit spies to the covert missions that are best suited for them during World War II. In the 50s and 60s, universities start using it to try to figure out how they can admit students with personalities that will be conducive to success, to creativity. And it really becomes this omnipresent thing between the 50s and, say, the 90s. And I can talk a little bit more about any single one of those strands, you know, the university, the
sure.
corporation, the military. But maybe it's just enough to say that what I find very interesting about this history is the way in which it really enters these institutions on the backs of a couple of true believers, you know, people who are really wedded to the ideas that Isabel Myers-Briggs is making visible, and also to the mechanism of the questionnaire and the kind of work that's doing to make the mass testing of personality possible. So not just one person working with an analyst to try to figure out their different aspects of their personality, but something that can be administered to, you know, thousands of people at any given time.
Well, it seems that there are several things that are in play here. One is our developing our understanding of what psychology is, what personality is, maybe even what character is. And this was a time in American history where businesses were looking to fill jobs, and there were people coming back from war and looking to figure out how you're going to fit this person into that slot.
Yes, so I think the time that we're talking about is a moment when the labor force of the United States just explodes post-World War II. And all of a sudden, there seemed to be this sort of massive surplus of possible workers to fit to the available jobs. And so in her first sort of thumbnail sketch of the indicator, Isabel analogizes using hiring somebody to finding the right pair of shoes, the right fit. And she says, you could try on every shoe in the store if you didn't know what size they were, if they didn't have the size written on the outside of the box. But we could avoid a painful fit if only we knew on the outside of the box what the size was. And for her, giving people personality tests or administering the indicator to them and finding out their type is akin to knowing what size shoe is inside of the box.
Which you can understand the appeal, you know, that there, if you can put someone in a box, then it's going to work, right?
Right. And a lot of the early days and the early uses of the indicator are very much to that purpose. So trying to figure out what types are best suited to certain kinds of jobs. And so, you know, the indicator is being used to hire, it's being used to fire, it's being used to promote. Occasionally, it's being used with executives to figure out what the best executive type is, and then it's being used in an early version of what today we would call executive coaching. But it's very much sort of being used in the service of making the American corporation, and I should say it's very much being used in the service of making white-collar labor something that we can rationalize.
And promote and value.
Yes, exactly. So Edward Hay, the man that Isabel was working with, the consultant that Isabel was working with, was keenly aware of the fact that when it came to service labor, there were no good metrics for figuring out what made you good at managing other people. And so the reason that he gravitates to personality tests instead of, say, tests of aptitude is because he thinks that they get at something like the soft skills that are required in human management. And Isabel is also very aware of this, too. And one of the reasons the indicator takes off the way it does is because of the rise of service labor in the United States after World War II.
And why is it called Myers-Briggs and not Briggs-Myers?
Well, it was called Briggs-Myers for a long time. But, one of the companies that was very interested in purchasing the indicator and wanted badly to validate it was the Educational Testing Service, ETS, the publishers of the SAT.
Right.
And in the late 50s and early 60s, they wanted to find a personality test that would do for personality testing what the SAT had done for aptitude testing so that every university, every workplace would require it. And so they tried to validate Myers-Briggs, and they couldn't. But one of the things that they suggested was that they change it from Briggs-Myers to Myers-Briggs because the BMTI sounded too scatological. It sounded like, the bowel movement type indicator. So they didn't think they could market anything under that with that title. So they strongly urged her to change it.
And obviously it did stick. And I'm just curious then about sort of how the Myers-Briggs has taken off and how both Catherine and Isabel would think about it today.
Well, it's interesting to me that it only really took off after both of them died. Isabel passed away in 1980, and she had been diagnosed with cancer in the early 70s. It recurred in 1975, and at that point, the indicator didn't have a publisher and it didn't have a home. And there was a real fear that when she died, it would die with her, in particular because she was so obsessive about maintaining her intellectual property. She never showed the answer keys to anybody. During the Cold War, when she was working with ETS, she said she was worried about distributing the answer keys lest the Russians get hold of them.
Wow.
So there's a touch of paranoia in that as well, I think. And so there is this real fear that when she died, her creation, what she had dedicated the second half of her life to, would cease to be. And she ultimately sold it to a company called CPP, which is still the publisher of the type indicator. And CPP required her to make the type descriptions more generic so that, anybody who got any type really could see themselves in it. And
Hear you doing the dance with the music. That's Merve Emery. That's okay. We're talking about Myers-Briggs, and do stay with us. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Merve Emery. She's a professor of English literature at Oxford University, and we're talking about her most recent book. It's called The Personality Brokers, The Strange History of Myers-Briggs and the Birth of Personality Testing. We've got a lot of people that want to join the conversation, but just complete that thought about the organization that essentially promotes or runs Myers-Briggs today.
Right. So CPP, which is the company that sells the indicator today, before they purchased it from Isabel in the late 70s, one of the things they mandated was that she actually rewrite the descriptions of the individual types. Mm. So Isabel's descriptions of an ENFJ or an INTP were incredibly specific. And if you read the versions of the type descriptions that she produced in the 40s and 50s, it's hard to imagine that if you got any type as a result after taking the indicator, you could identify with it because they were quite specific. But now I feel like really you could identify with almost any of the types because the descriptions have become quite roomy. They've become quite capacious. And this is, very much part of the design behind selling it, right? That if you get any particular type, you're able to identify yourself in it. And so you think it applies, or you think it's valid, or you think it's reliable, or it feels that way, even if it isn't necessarily valid or reliable.
And reflects, it seems to say, as I said, we took the test yesterday, and, we were all pretty pleased with how it described who we were.
Well, I guess my question for you is, hearing some of your colleagues' types, did you feel like you disagreed with any of the ways in which any of their types?
I didn't actually disagree, because I think they were campaigners. I was I'm a protagonist, whatever that means. And we could see that they were bits and pieces of us, and it made sense. There was nothing that was particularly jarring, but as you just said, the language is kind of roomy and generic, so mm-hmm. you can say, yeah, that sounds like me, sort of.
Right, exactly. And who wouldn't want to be a protagonist? I mean, nobody wants to be nobody wants to be the minor character, right? Of course you want to be the protagonist. Actually, it's funny, I bought my editor, he had a baby right before this book came out, and I didn't know what the baby's Myers-Briggs type was, obviously, but I did buy him a onesie that said protagonist on it with that type. So
well done. Let me read. We got a lot of comments here. Let me just read one from a Facebook comment from Alan, who said, about as valid as horoscopes. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I don't think that's wrong. But I mean, one of the things that I am really striving to do in this book is just bracket that question of scientific validity and scientific reliability, because I don't think it actually tells us anything interesting about the cultural history or the cultural logic of the indicator, and why it is that people continue to flock to it, and why they continue to defend it or denounce it with this kind of quasi-religious ardor. And to me, that's much more a question of language, and it's a question of culture rather than a question of science. And so I don't think you can get at that by talking about validity or reliability.
You mentioned this, and I think it was pretty obvious when we took the, I know test, they don't like the word test, took the indicator yesterday, is how kind of boring, for lack of a better word, how boring the questions were. And there were, I always have trouble with double negatives, so it's like it took me a little while to, what are they really asking me here?
Right.
But there is something so kind of ugh about what you're being asked.
And they're also really repetitive, right? So once you answer about 15 questions, you kind of know what the questions are setting you up for. So the reason that I'm really incapable of taking it, and was incapable of taking it the first time that I took it even, was that I'm a fairly close reader. I mean, this is what I do professionally. And so once I just figured out the pattern, it was impossible for me not to answer the questions totally consistently throughout. So one of the things they do when you take the indicator is they generate a kind of chart, a bar chart showing the strength of your preference. And if you look at my bar chart, like, my preferences are so totally strong in all directions. And that's just because I answer the questions completely consistently. Like, every question that's trying to suss out whether I'm an E or an I answer as an E. And so part
meaning
of
meaning extrovert, yeah.
As an extrovert, right. And so part of what this gets at, right, is how the questionnaire itself as a textual object, how the questionnaire itself is training you in a particular practice of projection, of projecting the self that you want to be, of projecting a coherent self who is consistent, who answers those questions consistently. And it's training you to think of yourself that way even before you encounter your result. And so I think people often put a lot of weight on the result itself. And what they miss is the way that the questionnaire and the way the questions are structured, and even that sort of boring, repetitive quality of them, is in fact doing a lot of work even before you get to the result to train you to think about the self in very particular ways.
And very subliminal ways, it sounds, as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that part of the benefit of making the question seem non-threatening is that they can do their work sort of covertly. And one of my favorite stories to this end, or one of my favorite examples to this end, is the example of Cambridge Analytica. And the way that Cambridge Analytica used a personality test not to actually glean any information about Facebook users to then manipulate for political purposes, but they actually use the test as a kind of Trojan horse, so that you would take the test and then click on the terms of service of the test, assuming that there could be nothing harmful in it, and then that would authorize Cambridge Analytica to scrape your Facebook profile for your data. And so I think that's, you know, in some ways totally brilliant, because of how it just exposes how the innocuous sense of the test is actually used for more kind of nefarious political purposes.
Interesting. Here's a Facebook comment from Elise. She says, I'm ESTP. I used to be ENTJ. I was pretty sure I changed as I raised my children, went through my menopause, and matured. A Facebook comment from Lori in some of the same territory here. I am INTJ. When I took it at college in the 80s, when we were administering it to residents' life staff, there actually was a nice variety of personalities that have been chosen by resident directors. This notion about you're changing profile, I guess, or you're changing personality type, which raises questions about, is our personality fixed or is it malleable? Where how do you wrestle with that, Merve?
Or what even is a personality in the first place, right? I mean, I think one of the very interesting things that took place at this class that I attended was that we had to learn how to speak the three rules of type. So the first rule that you actually alluded to before is that you never call the Myers-Briggs type indicator a test. It's an indicator because it indicates to you what you've indicated to it, which is a kind of marvelously tautological formulation. But there you have it. Yep. Two, your type never changes. And this was actually something we were made to chant over and over again sitting together in this class. Type never changes. Type never changes. Mm-hmm. And as our instructor there said, if somebody tells you their type changed, they are just wrong. And the third rule was that no type is better than any other type. But that question of change is so interesting. And it's so interesting that that first person whose comment you flagged talked about raising children.
Yes.
Because I would say that, my personality has undergone, or my, I don't even know if I should call it a personality, but my sense of self has undergone such tremendous shifts since having my own children that it actually makes me entirely skeptical of talking about a coherent self or a coherent personality at all. So for me, the impulse wouldn't be to say, well, my type changed. My impulse would be to say, look at the kind of ludicrousness of claiming that we have a type or a stable self at all, when in undergoing these sort of momentous life events, the incredible sort of porousness of ourselves becomes visible.
And there's this outside world that does have an impact on our life decisions and in many ways on who we are to some degree.
Well, and there are people, right? I mean, to me, one of the greatest challenges of parenting has been trying to figure out the ways in which I'm separable from my children and trying to, understand what those, if there is such thing as a bounded self or where the boundaries of the self lie when you're talking about children. And so, like I said, I think for me, one of the things that revealed is both how seductive this language can be. You want to know people and you want to believe that you can know people and know yourself. But that is almost entirely undone, I think, by just living through things like parenthood and marriage and loss and all of these things.
I'm kind of stuck on this re-education that you went through where you're chanting type never changes. I mean, that really is a re-education camp, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, it's really interesting. The people who control the archives, CAPT, the Center for the Application of Psychological Type, they are just so wedded to the ethos of Myers-Briggs. And I think the people who work there themselves have undergone the kinds of transformative and transcendent experiences that I describe people undergoing when they find out their type in the book. And they just don't want anything to cast any kind of doubt on those experiences because they have so thoroughly saturated their understanding of who they are and professionally what they've committed to. And so I think, you see these kinds of mantras, these chants, this refusal to entertain any kind of criticism, even if it is cultural rather than scientific, of what the indicator is or what personality is or what the self is. And I think it's a really profound defense mechanism that I've come up against in writing this book, which is that people want to believe and they don't want that belief to be in any way tainted. They don't want to be disenchanted.
Let me get back to some of our comments. And again, you can join our conversation. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can carry on a Facebook conversation we started yesterday. Let me read a Facebook comment from Katie. I'm ISTJ, which according to one's website means I'm Severus Snape. an email from Eric. Are there better personality tests to take?
Yeah, can I start with Severus Snape?
You can do because, Severus Snape.
I mean, my types are like, you know, are like Dick Cheney and Donald Trump. So I.
There you go.
I think it's really fascinating that we turn to fictional characters or, you know, insofar as public figures are characters, which they kind of are to us, right? We don't know them intimately, that we turn to fictional characters to try to orient ourselves to our own types. Because to go back to what I said at the very beginning of our conversation, the way in which type creates the sense of social belonging, we want to feel like we identify with people who are important, that people the world cares about or people that are important within, you know, the fictional universe of a book like Harry Potter or Game of Thrones or, you know, basically every prestige television show has a type table that tells you what types the different characters are. And I think that move or that elision between real personalities and fictional characters is also gets at something really interesting about what the type indicator does, is that it lets you tell a story about yourself. It lets you objectify yourself and treat yourself as a kind of character. And so in answering the questions on the questionnaire, what you're reflecting on is thinking, you know, how have I been in my life? And how has that brought me up to this present moment? And then once you get the results, the question is, well, okay, what do I do with my future so that I can bring myself more into alignment with who I am or what my preferences are? And that is essentially a practice of storytelling, of saying, you know, here's the past, here's the present, here's the future, here's how I want them all to connect, and here's the narrative that takes me through it. So, you know, to get to your personality type, you're the protagonist, right? So you're the protagonist. You're the protagonist of that story that the questionnaire is very sort of subtly creating for you. And this is what I think those type tables are saying, you know, you are Severus Snape or you are
Michael
Dennis Targaryen.
Scott.
Yeah, Michael Scott, right?
The Office.
Yeah, it's giving you these cultural narratives that you can map your own onto and say, well, here's where that character started and here's where they end. And I either like it or I don't.
Well, I think in many ways we're all protagonists of our own story, right?
Are we, though? I don't know. I mean, I wonder about that.
The star of our own story, in a way?
Yeah, but I question if that's something natural or not. So, I mean, part of what I argue in the book is that the language of type and the preoccupation with personality and the preoccupation with the individual is itself something that we should historicize, and that we have inherited and we are beholden to this language of the liberal individual that makes the self, that makes the individual the most important imaginative unit of so much of what we do, whether it's the novels that we read and write or the companies that we work for. And I just wonder what that history, that imaginative history, would look like if we didn't have that commitment to the individual or that commitment to the self. You know, would we still think of ourselves as the protagonists in our own stories? Would our sense of our preferences, our wants, our desires, our needs be so individualized? Or could we think of a more sort of collective way of thinking about preference? Would we stop this sort of obsessive, this fixation with the self? And would we think instead about how to organize a more just society? That to me is the ultimate failing of these tests, is that they don't really allow for the kind of collective imagination that I at least am committed to.
Well, that's fascinating, and I do not disagree with that at all, and we're almost out of time here, but it's such a provocative question, I think, for now, for our country, for our society, about the sort of larger good and the larger society that's out there and what responsibility we have for people beyond ourselves.
No, absolutely. Yeah. What obligations do we have to other people? And imaginatively, what does that mean we have to do in the kinds of languages that we adopt to describe the self? But more broadly, I mean, how do we, you know, Theodore Adorno really compellingly argues that the problem with these tests is not the tests themselves, but they're symptomatic of the way that capitalism and industrial modernity have actually created types in the world, right? People who are allowed to invoke this language of individualism, and people from whom this language of individualism is not given to. And so the whole idea of individualism is fraught with these questions of class and gender and race. So how can we get away from that to something that looks like a better and more just world?
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Merve. Emre, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
And you're very welcome. The book is called The Personality Brokers, The Strange History of Myers-Briggs and the Birth of Personality Testing. She joined us from the BBC studios at Oxford University, and she's a professor of English literature at Oxford. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us.